Mr. Springfield, how can I hope to achieve such greatness?
A noble spirit embiggens the smallest man.
Yeah!
Springfield rules!
Way to go, Springfield!
Embiggens? Never heard that word before I moved to Springfield.
I don't know why. It's a perfectly cromulent word.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody. Welcome to another interview episode of Talking Simpsons. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, who's with me today.
Embiggening your ears, it's Henry Gilbert.
That's right, and there's a reason why you said embiggening, because this interview is all about Dan Graney, the man who invented embiggening. But he's done more than that, folks. He has been writing for The Simpsons on and off for, I'd say, almost 20 years?
I think it is 20 years.
Yeah.
Because, the season, he joined in season 7.
Yeah.
And that would have aired in 1995. He joined in 95, over 20 years.
23 as of now. So yes, we talked about him on the recording of King Size Homer. That was his first episode. But he's gone on to write episodes such as Summer of 4'2", My Sister and My Sitter, the Genesis Tub segment of Treehouse of Horror 7, and so many more episodes. And he is a Harvard friend.
We get to hear about how he came into the show, how he was pals back in Harvard with Bill Oakley and also Josh and other folks and George Meyer, all these folks who'd work at the Harvard Lampoon and then started working on the show. And we really get an insight from Dan on this about what it's like to be a writer for the show, not just in writing an episode that is credited to you, but also the rewrite room and what rewriting a episode and adding jokes to a very gag-based show like The Simpsons is like.
Yeah, it's very much about we talk about the collaborative nature on the show and how some writers aren't credited for the best jokes just because there can only be one writer credit. Everyone else is just a producer. Just a producer. Mm-hmm. Just a Simpsons producer.
And we get to hear about his rivalry with David X. Cohen over words and stuff. But
I gotta say, I don't need to sell you, listener, on this interview because you're clearly listening to it, but I have to say that I've heard things from Dan that I've never read before in an interview or never read in Simpsons websites or whatever. It's very eye-opening in terms of just like his place in the show and everyone he worked with.
And just remember that embiggening just became an official word in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary this month.
Put it in all of your college papers. They can't cross it out. It's a real word now. So yes, please enjoy this interview with Dan Graney. So joining us today on this very special interview episode of Talking Simpsons is Dan Graney, who's recently been in the news for being the creator of the word embiggen. It is now an official word according to Webster's. They govern this?
I guess it was their call.
I don't know why it's their call. They're just a company, but I guess they get to make this call.
It's now a officially corporate recognized word, Dan. How does that make you feel? Have people been reaching out to you about this?
Yeah, well, it has been fun to get some likes and whatever on Twitter and some, you know, that's quite enjoyable, but being a thin-skinned person that I am, I focus only on the naysayers and doubters. And of course, somebody, after I coined this term, which I did coin it, it didn't pre-exist in my knowledge or the knowledge of any of us, it was an active invention. Somebody somehow found that it had a prior usage in a diction, in a Western newspaper 100 years ago.
Oh, what? No.
Yes. So there's always somebody that comes out of the woodwork and says, you didn't create it. And I feel accused. I wasn't trying to claim that I did. I just pitched it. And then this happened. But I really think the correct description analytically is that it was an independent invention of it. You know, because it had certainly died from the English language, if it was ever even in it.
And were you aware that a popular Marvel comic book character had been using the phrase as well?
No, not at all. Wow. And the really exciting thing for me is that this happened before the word cromulent got in the dictionary.
I was going to ask you about that. Was that David S. Cohen's invention, cromulent?
Yes, it was. And David, you know, I love David and I admire everything he does. So this is said with love, but come on, David, that was a pile-on. That was a classic pile-on where one person sort of does something and then another person goes over. But that's fair. It's fair. That's the game that we're playing where you're trying to go one better and do something even more fun. So, but for a long time, cromulent had more like hits on Google than embiggen. But somehow we nosed him out in where it counts.
Well, so Dan, you had joined this show in season 7, but you had known, I know you had known Bill Oakley back at Harvard, but did you know any of the other writers, either for The Simpsons or elsewhere?
Sure. Well, I was a member of the Harvard Lampoon, and by a quirk of fate, I wound up being the president of it because I was out of school for a good chunk of the time, and they all started hating each other, and they didn't know me, so they elected me president. So Bill Oakley was treasurer when I was president. David Cohen was also on the staff. Stephen Tompkins, who Bill Oakley hired at the same time as me, was also on that staff. We had actually all four of us had worked together on a bunch of stuff in college, including a parody of USA Today that was nationally distributed, and that was a lot of fun. So, and then I had known Conan when I was in college, and I'd known Greg Daniels, but they weren't anybody that I've been quite as close to as those guys.
Wow, man, that's quite a class of people in Harvard there.
I think that to be fair, you know, I think there's been there's something like, what is it, chain immigration, like Donald Trump is trying to stop. There's a chain immigration phenomenon, you know, that your friend is doing it, and suddenly it seems possible, and you have a way to get a script to somebody. So it's advantageous. I think those other people were all quite talented. and then also in that era, the idea of writing comedy or of having the attitudes that the Simpsons were looking for were more obscure than they are now. I think the sort of attitude, a comedic sort of sarcastic, ironic, caustic attitude is much more prevalent now than it was back then.
I think thanks to The Simpsons.
I think definitely it's been part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I definitely noticed, like, 15 years ago I would go to an improv performance and it seemed really hokey and dated. And then 10 years ago or 5 years ago I went to an improv performance and it seemed just as sharp and funny, and as, like, the sensibility had shifted. And I felt like we no longer had an edge.
So you have had a strange journey as a comedy writer. You went from practicing law to being a Simpsons writer. What was that like? What was the catalyst for leaving your old profession behind?
Well, I would say I'm not really one of those people that was like a real lawyer who then became a comedy writer. I was sort of a failed comedy writer who went to law school to sort of try and maintain some sort of middle-class standard of living, and, you know. And then when I saw that my friends were actually making a go of it, and my more talented friends had actually managed to break in and encourage me to take another shot at it, I did. But so I didn't have some, you know, great legal career that was unfolding. I was sort of hanging in there. Richard Appel, if I may, another lawyer turned commoner, Richard Appel had, like, this glittering legal career, even though I did go to the Harvard Law School, because Harvard takes back some of its, you know, they try and redeem their investment. But Richard was having this great legal career where he's working for the U.S. District Attorney for the Southern District, which is very prestigious, and doing clerkships. I was just sort of scraping along.
So you joined in season 7 with Bill Oakley. Like, what was that writer's room like? And I was also curious, you know, you've been on the show so long, like, how did Bill and Josh compare as showrunners to, you know, Mike Scully, Al Jean, or even Matt Selman these days?
You know, Bill was my right-hand man when I was president of Lampoon, and Bill is a brilliant executive. Like, there's lots of people, well, there's a number of people that are good writers, and Bill and Josh are both excellent writers. But Bill is a natural CEO. He just seems like he should be running U.S. Steel. he does. I think, was more the leader in their partnership. I think they creatively were equal partners, but in terms of their management style, I think it was Bill's management style. And it was really well thought through to, both have very high standards and also have very rational methods. And so, like, for instance, like, Bill will never tell the same anecdote repeatedly. He'll wait till all the people he's going to tell the anecdote to are present, then tell it. And that sort of clarity has been, it's hard to come by. And so the process was really beautiful and beautifully thought through. Then I think that by the end of their term, maybe Mike Scully felt that the show had gotten a little bit too artsy and wanted to make it a little bit more, you know, family-based, and that was definitely the push, and a reasonable push in the first couple seasons. But in his, you know, his third and fourth season, I think that sort of ran out of sort of basic meat and potato stories, and the show went insane, which I was a big proponent of and the supporter of doing going crazy. And then, but so there was a real arc in Mike's term as leader, and then Al, you know, has had a more consistent style from start to finish, you know, and he's a very capable, you know, consistent, steady Eddie.
In interviews and commentaries, I've heard that Oakley and Weinstein years, those were the longest hours, the staying till 3 a.m. to, you know, finally figure out that one joke you needed. Was that your experience there?
It was my privilege to have that experience. I loved it. I was more than happy to stay till 3 a.m. Trying to get the right sign joke or the right name for Don Brodka, you know, the detective, which was one of those occasions where we stayed so late for hours. And yes, there was definitely some psychological problems that were producing. But, you know, they're my kind of psychological problems. You know, if that wasn't something I was up for, I was in the wrong place in my feeling. And so I thought it was tremendously fun. And I remember one time, I forget which episode, but we worked on this line, like somebody had painted us, we'd written ourselves into a corner with the setup, you know, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, you know, which was that popular book in the 90s about gender differences. And that was the setup. We needed something that was a punchline off of that. We just could not get it. and at some point, people started putting money on the table. Like, whoever gets this line will get all this money. And I think it was like 1 or 2 in the morning, and there was like several $100 in a pile on the table. And George Meyer pitched that Homer, somebody, Marge said, well, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. And then Homer says, fine, give us the one with the monsters. You know? Wow. It was a good line.
That's a great
line. It was a great line. We were stuck in this little corner, and with, you know, it kind of, it would be fun. You get a little intoxicated, a little punchy in those late night sessions. So I loved it. Right. Well, they had very high standards. And yeah, I think in their first year, you know, they really had no ability to balance other things. But, you know, I didn't have a family. Whatever. I loved it.
Well, do you remember what your first, like, your first pitched joke was that went in the show? We interviewed Mike Scully, and he remembered when he finally struck up the courage to pitch a joke in the room because he found it very intimidating. Do you recall what yours was?
Well, I was pitching right when I walked through the door because these were people. Bill is like a buddy of mine. Josh is a buddy of mine. I felt very comfortable immediately, and I've always pitched more than I probably should. So, like, one of my mottos that I've had to, mantra that I've had to reiterate is, hey, they can't all be gems. So I'm sure I pitched 100 bad things before I got something in the script. And I think, having talked to some people who were there, they were pretty annoyed that this new kid was coming in, this guy coming in, pitching all this bad shit, not knowing it's bad, and just being going on his merry way. But eventually I did notice I wasn't getting things in the script. And so that became a concern. And I possibly the first thing that I was like sure went in the script might have been the name of the video game Bone Storm.
Oh, wow.
That might have been. And then there was another thing that went in and came out that I so loved, I still which has been an experience of mine. But we needed a name of a country band, something. And I remember pitching a Furl Flag and the Second Helping Boys. And I thought that was pretty good, darn good name for a jug band.
Well, Bloodstorm is great, and I bet several video game companies are mad that you stole that because there have been games like Bulletstorm and Bloodstorm. They can't use Bonestorm now because it's a joke.
Right, but we beat them to it. I think that, like, to be that Bulletstorm, they might have done anyway, but Bloodstorm, I don't think anybody would have gone that freaking psycho. Bulletstorm for sure. That's easy. But Bloodstorm, that's really wrong.
Well, see, you know, we just did an episode of our podcast on your first episode as credited writer, King Size Homer. I know you mentioned that on the commentary, too, that George Meyer, you know, put a ton of jokes in it, and you were giving a lot of credit on there. But I did wonder, like, what did you miss from your script that you wish was in there? Or were there any, like, cut jokes or plot points that you wish were in there?
Oh, well, one, I would say that George contributed a lot of jokes. The story and the take on Homer, the joie de vivre, was Bill and Josh. Hmm. You know, the basic story was a Bill and Josh story, and that it's very much Bill's sensibility that Homer would delight in this gaining of weight and all this. And so the fun, the whole attitude of it did come from Bill and Josh. And George pitched a lot of great jokes, too. Super important. But there was one line when Homer is wearing his muumuu, and he sees himself in the mirror. And in my original draft, Homer was like, I took Homer down further emotionally to a more emotionally dark place. And Homer, like, looking at himself in the mirror, and the whole facade of jollity breaks up, and he goes, I feel bad about myself. And that line became George Meyer's mantra for the next 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And so that was very gratifying. It didn't go in the script, but it had a life of its own, you know, so that was fun.
I love that. I can just imagine Dan Castellaneta just very depressed and like, I feel bad about myself.
You can hear it in your head. Oh, yeah, it's great.
I think that maybe represented, you know, if it were like a little bit of my own style and voice, there was a little bit starker, blunter, harsh tone that could sometimes come out, you know. So maybe that was like just not within. That jumped out to George because it was just not quite the tone the show had, you know.
So Summer of 4'2" is a great episode, one that you wrote. Yeah. How much of that did you pull from your own childhood, or was that just like sort of an amalgam of kids who grew up in the 60s and 70s?
No, that was a very personal episode for me, very much based on my life, but it's also a very personal episode for a number of other people that were there. So it's like I wrote that story. I can definitely say is like my, you know, my story. I wrote it, I pitched it, but other people so had lived such similar things that that they were also able to get right into those shoes, you know, and pitch from their own experience. So though I say, yes, this is what came out at the end was quite close to what I pitched, it was also very much owned by some other people. In particular, I think of Steve Tompkins, who's one of our great writers, you know, who loved Steve more than most people in the comedy world, was like novelistic or poetic in his obsession with observed detail, you know, and he just loved to get stuff right. And so, like, I just remember, like, there's something about a decorative rowboat full of geraniums, you know, there's like little touches all throughout that were like Steve, who is also like me from Massachusetts, also went down to Cape Cod and just totally was trying to get everything right. And then I think Bill and Josh had gone to their summers to Maryland or something. And, you know, like these sort of like porn, you know, Homer buying pornography and everything. That's pure Bill loving like American Graffiti and being that, you know. So I think that, and the Dud and all that, that's kind of Bill. But but the Lisa story, the Bart and Lisa rivalry, that was pure me, but then it became owned by other people too, you know, because they related to it. And then the ending thing, you know, was I pitched that thing with the crab or whatever. So, you know, the tone, I think the tone and the take was I have some ownership of, but it's joint custody.
So that episode and also My Sister, My Sitter have they both feature a schism between Bart and Lisa. Is that just a coincidence, or is that a dynamic that you like to write in your episodes?
That's a coincidence. My Sister, My Sitter was probably Bill Oakley's idea. You know, I think that was his pitch and you know, the indignity of it. I think that episode is really about indignity. You know, like your older boy is being babysat by his younger sister. It's just infuriating. So that was really, that's much more Bill's episode. I would say that for me, the themes of the summer one was like themes I related to of like, for personal repositioning and reinvention, sibling rivalry, certainly. The other thing that I thought was a little note that I've always been drawn to was sort of like Marge's desire to be Lisa's friend. And it's not, and it being a little sad You know, like the idea of the lonely mother that wants to be friends with her children or whatever, that is definitely something I have. I feel it, you know? Mm-hmm. What can I say?
Well, in that summer episode, I think one of my favorite lines in that is when Marge just so innocently corrects Lisa about Gore Vidal and just like, girls, Lisa, boys kiss girls.
Yes. And that's a room pitch, and God only knows who that was. But yes, that was Marge's nice, where you could do things that are clueless, but not mean. You know, like I don't know. I think in another episode, I think Tom Gamble pitched a line when they're at Disneyland or something that Marge says, "I hope I don't eat an elephant." Like, I don't know. Like she's just, what is wrong with you? It's just your cluelessness. But if you've had, you know, known some clueless ladies, it's, you know, you have to have a certain tenderness for him.
Yeah.
So I've been listening to a bunch of commentaries to prepare for this interview, and one thing that came up a few times was the fact that there was going to be a Planet Hollywood episode, and not much was said about it other than the fact that it was never made. Can you talk more about that? Like, who wrote it? If the jokes ended up anywhere?
I know nothing about that. That's at a high management level beyond my experience.
Okay, Doug. I just want to know like what it was all about. But
it's that in the Prince episode.
Yeah.
Well, there's the Prince episode. You know, there was an episode about a cult-like religious organization that I think ran into some bit of a minefield that never got produced.
Yeah, the Movementarians one got kind of close to that, but it's not. That's not the same though.
I think there was another one that went much closer. Too close. We're too close to the sun.
I'm going a little bit in order here on your credited episodes. But you did write the Genesis Tubbs segment in Treehouse 7, which did you pitch that one too, or did somebody else say, like,
no,
we're going to parody this?
I don't think so. I don't really recall. I doubt it. You know, I think I did pitch it, but I didn't know that it had been a Night Gallery episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know. I feel like somebody shrinking is not, you know, it's pretty obvious, right? So I don't feel it's like a great brainstorm to think of a shrinking episode.
And were you aware that Treehouse segment was then used as an example of Simpsons Did It in the South Park episode about Simpsons Did It?
Yeah, that was gratifying. And you got to give those guys respect for that episode. Like, that's a courageous thing, a generous way to respond to that thing. But they did some great stuff that we haven't done. But
you guys can't, like, murder as many people on The Simpsons as they can.
Can I mention one thing? Is while I can see that the credited episodes provide structure to an interview, and I get it, it's very interesting that there's a whole other side of the street, you know? Like, I would say that on the one hand, like, my credited episodes, you know, overstate. If you said, oh, I wrote this or I wrote this, they overstate my contribution by the credit. Now, you guys get into that and you correct that, and that's great. But there's another thing, which is all of our participation in the total culture of it is kind of not captured by that. Like, and I don't know if anything can capture it, but like little motifs and ideas and concerns and takes. I'm just saying, if you're going to take all my episodes away from me, which is fine, fair, you've got to give me a certain percentage of everybody else's episodes. You got to figure out a method.
Well, I will say you had mentioned some of the stuff like Bone Storm, but also in that episode, get the Range Rover mom and Gavin. Like, I do really love those pair, because I think when that episode aired, I was a little bit of Gavin. I was the spoiled kid who was mean to his mom.
Yeah, I think that is the first joke about a millennial ever put on television.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I saw that happening in a dry cleaner. I couldn't believe it. How terrible this kid was to his mother and how indulgent she was of him in return. And then I realized this is something that's going on. So, you know, I thought it was funny. We put it in and a bunch of the writers loved it. I think Mike Scully thought this kid was so awful. He just wanted nothing more to do with it. Mike so disapproved of that treating your mother that way that he banished the character.
Well, I think he was the one family man at the time, or one of a few on the staff.
Right, right. And I think he's a really good dad, and I think take some of those issues more seriously than, you know, or, you know, we're seeing them from an outside perspective. You know, just look at this horrible family.
You mentioned, yeah, what it's like to be in the writer's room and having to, and just contributing the whole thing. Like, when you get, isn't it when you get assigned a script, like, you're kind of out of the room for a little while, right? When you're writing a script, like, are there then some episodes, like, you didn't get to really
Put stuff in? Among my many list of grievances, my long list of grievances is the stuff that I didn't help write. That is so hurtful that they could do such amazingly great work without me, but it's, let the facts speak for themselves. Chimpanz A to Chimpanz Z, whole, like, Troy McClure, you know, mm-hmm. Stop the Planet of the Apes, I want to get off. That wasn't because I was out on script. It was because I think we were working in two rooms at that point, and the other room did this amazing thing. And it's like, what? And I can't claim to be part of it? If I'd been in the room, I could persuade myself that somehow I had been the person that got the ball rolling. There would be some way for me to argue myself into believing I had contributed. But I had nothing to do with it. And, you know, I just loved it when, as soon as I heard it, it was truly painful.
What?
And I've seen that again and again. I've seen the show do good work without me, so, you know.
Well, as you were telling us before, the fact that your name is on an episode just means you wrote that first draft or the first script for the episode. What are what are misconceptions?
I just want you guys to find a way to reflect the other side of the point, which is that we give to other people's episodes and have, you know, this, it's like you're an ingredient in a soup. That's all I'm saying. I'm an ingredient in the soup.
Do you get a lot of misconceptions about what being a Simpsons writer is like? Like, people think you write for a certain character, or that every word in the script is yours? Do you hear just a lot of, I mean, people approaching you not really knowing how a comedy writer works?
Well, the misconception I'm encountering right now is that you think anybody cares about the Simpsons.
We do.
You do, and Cognoscenti do, of course. And we love that, and we try to still, you know, produce episodes that you would like. But it's not as cool as it once was, I'll say that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't, like, what you tend to get these days is, you know, oh, are they still making new ones of those?
Oh,
and
geez.
It seems like 50% of the time that's truly innocent, you know, from some regular person, and 50% of the time it's a sneaky little jab by somebody that knows perfectly well that they're making.
Ouch. I also know you did do the Everything's Coming at Milhouse line, which I've seen get used a lot by folks in the Simpsons fan community or just online by people making jokes. Like, what do you think of that type of fandom? Or, I guess, shit posting is the term for it, of just people who make goofy posts using Simpsons lines and making some kind of fun turn on it.
Well, you know, God bless him. I feel like, you know, the culture of ownership of ideas and ownership of things is a little overstated. Mm. You know, like, when, you know, even Everything Come Up Milhouse, you know, obviously the phrase Everything's Coming Up Roses pre-existed, so I added one word. So, you know, I can't be too precious about it, and I like the recombinatorial element of our culture, and when I see the obverse argument being made that you can't appropriate things, you can't use things, I feel like that is, you know, suffocating creativity. I'd rather people make it their own. So that's fine with me. But I will say that I much prefer the people saying or doing things that show that it had some meaning to them as it, what I originally intended. You know, I've met somebody who had a tattoo that said Everything's Coming Up Milhouse. I've knew a bunch of artist people that are now in their late 30s, and, you know, that had a certain resonance for them of poor kid, the loser, whatever, getting his day in the sun, and the generosity of it, you know, had some meaning to them. So, and that was gratifying to me. They can wreck it, sure, fine, go ahead.
I know. I would say in Simpsons fandom there's probably more Milhouses than Barts.
For sure.
Oh, it was pretty much a room full of Milhouses right there, you know, but written by Milhouse.
We asked this of Bill Oakley, and I'm just curious if you had any input on this. Is were there any ideas or jokes you really wanted to make during your run there that just couldn't make it, that couldn't be fleshed out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've had episodes that I've pitched that got rejected that were giant catastrophes. Like, pitching and eating it hard was certainly not fun. And the episodes themselves, I think, were good, you know, like, so they were, but to me, at least, they were somewhat realized. When I pitched it, I had it was all there, you know, and so that they didn't say yes to it is hurtful, but I don't feel like it was something that was like left undone. I feel like, well, I did it and they just didn't want it.
Well, yeah, I guess pitching is like an art unto itself, right? Because you have to,
yes.
It's not just coming up with the idea. You then have to sell your boss on it. Like, were there some writers in your time? I mean, you're still with the show, but are there some writers who were particularly good at it, would you say?
Yes. Actually, I would say that it's the one day of the year where you really think, wow, this is kind of an all-star team because, you know, people really bring it. And they polish their work and everybody shines in their own different way. You know, like Max Prost and Tom Gamble do this like Smothers Brother routine where they're interacting as like a comedy duo. You know, it's very performative. Or, you know, somebody else might do something that is just relentless, like Ian Maxtone Graham would, you know, love to do very meticulously constructed things, and he would present you that, or Stuart Burns would do these mind-blowing, mathematically structured things. I don't know. People really were like themselves at a very high level on those days. And everybody has done this so much that almost everybody is good at it, you know, in their own particular way. I would say I tend to eat it more than because, you know, I was hired by Bill and Josh, and Bill and Josh loved big concept ideas, and I did too. You know, I was a big supporter when they first had the idea of 22 short episodes. I was a big supporter of that. I was a big supporter of all that stuff. So after they left, I was still trying to swing for those fences, and I think the strike zone changed somewhat, where it became a greater emphasis on more sentimental, emotionally centered stories and less on concept stories. And so I just had an uneven transition to that style. I mean, I love sentimental stories, but I, you know, also just wanted to do big idea stories.
So during your early tenure on the show, you and the rest of the team experienced the loss of Phil Hartman. And I'm just curious, how did that affect you? And were there any plans to put Phil in any future scripts that just sort of had to be taken away?
Again, you can't talk to a private about this grand strategy. Go talk to the general. You know, Phil was not somebody I'd ever met personally. You know, we wrote for him. He was an astonishing talent, you know, and it was a terrible loss to the show creatively. But I didn't know where they wanted to go with his characters or what he wanted to do. I mean, I was just, you know, basically a fan who you know, had the same experience of the tragedy of it all that any other fan would have. So.
Because I just noticed after his passing, there were a number of jokes of like, well, we need to have a video for March to watch about anger management in traffic, but it can't be Troy McClure anymore, so you have to create a new character for that. Was that kind of difficult at the time?
I don't really recall whether... I think often they were just right around things. You know, when he was there and he was available, your mind would naturally go to him, but when he wasn't, I think you just think of another way to tell the story. And, you know, he was so iconic, you know, that not only do you just don't want to do anything that looks like a ripoff of him, you know, like, you know, it was just, he was so great and just leave, you know, that year is over. It's time to do something else. Those old, you might know me from, you know, which were a classic joke form in itself. And I believe Bill Oakley and I could elaborate on one, which was the contrabulous fabtraption of Professor Horatio Huffnagel.
That is a great one.
I pitched the fabulous contraption of Professor Horatio Huffnagel, and Bill properly, correctly changed it to the contrabulous fabtraption, which of course elevated. But you don't get a contrabulous fabtraption unless you have a fabulous contraption, people.
You got to start somewhere.
And also that in one of Phil's last episode, Realty Bites, that was Gil and Cookie Kwan first appeared in there, which I think, so as you, I mean, Gil, they both have had legs, but I'd say Gil has appeared quite a lot after that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Gil, that was my episode, and that idea was suggested by Mike Scully, that Marge becomes a realtor, but he didn't have anything further than that, I think. So I think the idea of a, you know, murder house or whatever was my idea, and obviously you need some other realtors, you need some people on the make, right, to be realtors. I thought of Shelley from, you know, Glengarry Glen Ross and Jack Lemmon's characterization. I didn't realize that we'd actually already had Jack Lemmon on the show.
That's right.
Right. And so, but if you look, like when Jack Lemmon was just being Jack Lemmon, he didn't really go hard enough at it, you know. So I think Gil was like a stronger take on Shell than the character he'd done beforehand. You know, like it was more pushed and accentuated and worked a little bit better in the Simpsons context to have him be so sweaty, you know.
He is so pathetic. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, so the other thing that I always liked about Gil, and we always tried to write, and when it really does come from Glengarry Gone Rot, was the sense that he still had some moxie, and he still had some pep in his step. And you know what? He's this close to turning it around, you know? And, you know, to give him, not to just make him like a guy who's sleeping in a dumpster, but to make him a guy like, that this is where it's all turning around, you know?
he's still planning. He's got plans and schemes, and he's not just giving up.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it was delightful to me when I was not at the show at that time. They did an episode where things really worked out for Gil, and he went to Scottsdale, and his life. Yeah, and I thought, well, that was how I had seen the character, you know, that he had some word momentum, not just down. But of course, it was, you know, homage to Glengarry Glen Ross.
Did the writing of 30 Minutes Over Tokyo require any hands-on experience? Had anyone actually been to Japan, or did anyone go to Japan for that episode? Yeah. And did you hear from any Japanese Simpsons fans about your America's take on them?
No, that was written by Donick and myself after leafing through Fodor's Japan for 10 minutes. I think all the rap... Everything that's Japanese in it is one of the things that they would pull out to the margin on Fodor's Japan, like, you know, like a little picture with like italics, red italics type, you know, the 47 Ronin is a tradition. Okay, well, we've got to hear something. So it was a combination of my flipping through Fodor's and Donick just making up what he figured Tokyo should be like. And so that Homer would want to go to America Town, the restaurant, you know, and We of course, everyone had heard that they had fancy toilets. So, you know, so Homer's, like, not giving a shit attitude was very Donick. And I was the brains of the operation who leafed through Fodor's for 20 minutes.
Well, so you haven't been to Tokyo yourself?
I have been to Tokyo since, repeatedly. Oh, and cool. I love it. That The Simpsons has zero visibility there. And, you know, it just doesn't really resonate with their culture. The smart alecky, you know, attitude that Bart has towards his parents is not seen as amusing, you know, and then that particular episode, a joke was added in the course of the rewrite where Homer, I think, picks up the Emperor and throws him into a dumpster full of used sumo thongs, which I did not really think that was the greatest pitch, but whatever, went in. And that has meant that it would not be shown in Japan because it's not respectful to their...
Whose idea was the seizure robots? Do you recall that?
Oh, that was probably George. George or Bill and Josh. You know, George was really amused by the Japanese game show culture, you know, and I think Bill and Josh were into Japanese popular culture, like Mr. Sparkle and stuff like that. You know, that's sort of like a Bill and Josh, you know, thing. But I think the fair amount of it from Donick and my first pass date in, and I think Donick and I also wrote, I pitched the Bible stories as an episode, but then I didn't get to write one of them.
That's so odd. Yeah.
So the Bible stories, if you will, within the show, that's one of my actual reasonable claims to fame because it was the first non-Halloween trilogy. And it sort of opened up the door, like, oh my God, there's like, here's 100 more episodes we can squeeze out of this thing.
that had quite a dark ending of them all going to hell. Was that in your pitch?
No, that was probably George. George kind of hated that episode. I don't know.
Aww.
Yeah, it's okay. I think he got on board in the end. one thing we should talk about, if we may.
Sure. Yeah.
Bart to the Future.
Oh.
Yes, yeah.
That was actually coming up next.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to. For me, the issue was not like that we predicted Trump or whatever, which is great because that got us a little publicity. But for me, the issue was that episode. I really liked that episode, you know. And at the time it came out, Entertainment Weekly shortly thereafter called it the worst episode in the history of the show.
Oh,
ouch!
Ouch! It was a little harsh, and I felt like, and even the animators, I had a rebellion on my hands in the course of that episode. Because the vision of Bart was so pessimistic, you know, like everybody, all the animators have kind of seen themselves as Barts, the grown-up Barts. They wear Hawaiian shirts, they're fun, you have dune buggies, you know. And I was saying, I don't think it's going to work out like that.
Yeah, the vision of Bart as a stoned loser and moocher that he's, I mean, those are such it's too real, I think, because either people know a person in their family like that, or they come to the realization that they are that person in their family.
Yeah, it's a very realistically observed dirtbag.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. And you know, that he's, so like George and I used to butt heads, and George kind of half hated that episode and half loved it, like, because he knew there was truth in it. And so, like, I remember when we were pitching that Bart was kind of making his living off slip and fall lawsuits, you know, and George was getting into that. And the whole idea that, like, Bart's whole thing was claiming that other people had stolen his ideas, you know, like, somebody stole his idea for harbor tours, you know, and that, like, everything in his life needed a paperclip to make it work right. You know, you needed to turn his, you know, and we just had tons, everybody had tons of that material. It was really fun and fresh. That character was not really present on TV or the culture then before then. I mean, there was the Big Lebowski that sort of along those lines, but he's even played like it's all good.
He's not ashamed of himself at all. Bart, there are moments in that episode, I think, that make it hurt more because Bart is just faced with the reality of people telling him, like, you're a loser. And he's like, aw. It's definitely sadder.
So, but for me, I wound up losing a battle in that episode about, like, what their house was like. So he still has, like, the cute beach bungalow that the animators want to give him. He has the cute dune buggy that they want to give him. Mm-hmm. But the design for Bart was pure me. I feel like I won that battle. You see that, like, with the bags under his eyes and the little rat tail.
Rat tail's perfect.
No, you know, that episode did predict a Trump presidency, but it didn't. Was wrong on weed legalization. Like, that is in a couple states anyway, it's happened.
Right. Yeah, we're not infallible.
Well, so I mean that I mean the joke about a President Trump in there was just because, like, he had done a vanity I might run for president thing around when that episode aired, right? Was that the genesis of that joke?
No, I don't know who pitched it, but I think the genesis was, you know. And you can find out later, like, oh, Trump had actually mentioned presidential run or whatever since the 80s. So, but I think it was pitched by somebody who wasn't aware of the background. It was just pitching, you know, who's bad? Like, who will, you know, who could possibly get elected and screw things up? And Trump's, you know, populist swagger, you know, seemed like it, you know, people would appeal to people. It doesn't surprise me that he talked about running for president. I don't, you know. So, it was not super obscure to have that idea, but, you know, we really needed it for story purposes. Mm. We needed America to be in bad shape.
Well, you got it.
Yes. So you left the show for a bit and then came back. Did you notice any changes to the style of the show, or maybe any changes to the culture of the Simpsons staff?
Yes. I left when it was Mike Scully running the show, and then Mike was kind of de-Harvardifying the show. I don't think he was a super fan of the Harvard guys. And Mike's a working man's friend. He's Bruce Springsteen is his favorite performer, and Mike, you know, I think he just wanted the show to also be grounded in real life, not to be so nerdy. But Al seemed to have no such compunctions. So there was a sort of re-nerdification of the staff going on. And then I think Al had his own process of learning how to run the show. You know, he had worked previously in a partnership with Mike Reese, and I think they had worked with Sam Simon closely, and now he's on his own. I think it ultimately evolved to be a closer partnership with him and Jim Brooks than had existed previously. Mm. And that in the previous seasons that I'd been there, Jim Brooks's involvement was less than it was later. I would say that is the biggest difference.
Yeah, we had heard we interviewed Dana Gould, and he mentioned that sometimes a joke would get on the show and then James L. Brooks would see it and not be so happy about it, like, say, the chloroforming of Marge, which happened once.
Right, well, that was a late Scully. Scully lost his Scully, you know, the late Scully years, which are to me delightful, but they did get a little broad. And I think Brooks was like, what the hell's going on? Like, he probably hadn't watched the show in 10 years. And turns it on, and Homer's chloroform forming Marge.
Out of context, that's pretty wild. Yeah.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty big. I get it. I hear you. So, yeah, I think that, you know, and Brooke is, you know, concerned about emotional issues and concerned about the whole, you know, family ensemble, whereas, like, the, you know, the staff might just, you know, sort of ride Homer into crazy town, you know? So I think that was his re-engagement with the show, I think, was made sense. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned it earlier about the wackiness or the meta commentary, the kind of really ramped up in season 7 and 8, but it really, I think, like in 9 and 10, like 9 or 10 had the DOS bus episode that ended with, well, let's just say Mo and or Kirk, right. Kirk Van Houten getting his arm cut off and then it being reattached at the end. Like, so you mentioned, like, you were definitely in favor of the moving up of the wildness of the show and like the kind of trope commentary type thing.
Right. Well, I would say that I was in favor of let's have some fun. I would say that was my motto, you know, and Kirk, like, that was my pitch that they say that, like, the kids were saved later by Mo. I think George revised and repitched my pitch, but it was my pitch, then George's pitch. So he might dispute it, but come at me, bro. you know, that was just a, you know, let's have some fun with it. We cover the story. Do we really need to do the boring stuff? And I was just not interested in doing the boring stuff. Mm-hmm. For me, there are certain ideas that were amusing. Like, for me, a real touchstone of my approach to comedy is existential confusion. Like, the underlying uncertainty that people have about who they are, what they are, or anything. Like, just radical confusion. And so the, you know, idea that would be something that's going on in the show was fun to me. Like, that Homer might not know if he's Homer or if he's Clark Griswold. Mm-hmm. Like, he might be a little confused about this. You know, so it was more like about a psychology, you know, than about movies per se or metaculture, you know, whatever. But, you know, I don't know. I think the basic idea was to just have more fun with things. But I think the countervailing thing, which is that you're destroying the reality and nobody wants to watch the show if it doesn't feel real. They have a point, too. They have a point.
It's a fine line, yeah.
Yes, but I do think that, you know, this movie, I wrote a movie with my friend Matt Selman and Donna Carey. We wrote a movie called Red in 1997. Hmm. For instance, there were characters, like, Red is running for president, and he has a butler for some reason, and his butler's name is Butlerton. And, you know, and they, at one point, he goes to a hospital, which is St. New Hampshire Hospital, and then there's, like, one of his opponents in the presidential campaign was John F. Kennedy type, who was having an affair with Marilyn Monroe Jr., you know, and it was just, we were so, like, cooped up at The Simpsons by needing to keep it real that we wrote this movie that was just blowing off the reality every which way. And then I think George and other people read that, and I do feel like it got into the Kool-Aid at The Simpsons, you know, because I've seen jokes from that movie pitched many times, so I know it had its influence. But I think it was probably good that we got it back under control before it gets too dark. I mean, episodes that I super love, you know, like where they go and the monkey mine or the take the alligator and run, or, you know, with the underground jockeys living in a fiberglass tree, which, you know, it was getting pretty unreal at that point. But I love that stuff.
As a continuity nerd, sometimes I would be like, oh, I don't like this, but I did like when it would get even funnier when Homer would just hang a lantern on it and say, like, I'm going to kill those trolls, and then Bart's like, what?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was in that era, and I think it was George Meyer that pitched it, but that maybe even in that episode, where Comic Book Guy said,
worst episode ever, right?
Does anybody
care
what this guy thinks?
Yeah.
But didn't he also say, does anybody care what this guy thinks?
Yeah.
Like when they got the second horse. They got the second horse.
Yes.
And that was really George addressing you.
Oh, saying, damn it.
George is saying, dude, we have to do 100 fucking, excuse me, 100 episodes. We have to do all these episodes. It's really hard. If we can do a second episode where they get a horse and it's funny, is that such a crime? You know? So he addressed the nerds through Comic Book Guy.
I got that feeling too, yes.
One of the things that we talked to Bill Oakley about is that during his seasons with Josh, there were a lot of big shakeups to the show in terms of both continuity and lore. Things like saying Jebediah Springfield is a fraud and, you know, breaking up Milhouse's parents. After Bill and Josh left, was there more of a resistance to shaking up the status quo like that for the show?
Yes, and that is one of the rocks that I sailed into a couple times.
That you would pitch like a big change? And
For instance, a couple of years ago, I pitched an episode, you know, just about 2.5 years ago, I pitched an episode, you know, inspired by the true crime craze, you know, and Making Murderer and all that. Mm-hmm. I pitched with Bill's approval, with Bill's permission and Josh's permission, I pitched a reopening of Who Shot Mr. Burns, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I had it all worked out where we didn't need to unsay anything that had been said. Like, it wasn't like we're not going to change things, but there's some supplemental information we can add that reopens the case in an interesting way. And you know, like I had them, you know, like in those Making Murder, I had them go to the junkyard where the sunblocker is, and they're measuring how wide it was and how wide the radius of shade would have been, and you know what, there's two kinds of shadow, you know, there's a primary shadow and the secondary shadow. You know, I was excited. I actually feel like I made a story that accepted the reality of the old thing, but was fun and new and contemporary in this true crime way. And boy, did that die.
I would have approved that. I really like that idea, actually.
I want to see that now.
Yeah.
Boy. Yes, thank you. No, I think it's one for the us out there. But Jim Brooks did not like the idea of revisiting, you know, the story behind the story or whatever. Mm. He just and I felt like, well, you know, the show has done that with great success in some times, and even Who Shot Mr. Burns was a play on a pop cultural motif of Who Shot JR, you know, so like the true crime is the Who Shot JR of now. It's a pop cultural phenomenon of, you know, isn't it fair to update that story with this new contemporary motif? But the answer was no.
you're working on the show still, right? And I've noticed, especially in this last season, there were several kind of either outright sequels or picking up of things like the monorail came back as a plot point, the Camp Krusty. There were definitely some sequels in there. Is this something like the staff is more open to right now than they were previously?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good point. I think that sometimes what happens is, you know, somebody pitches somebody, some visionary leader such as myself pitches something and it gets rejected and eats it hard and is thought to be a moron. And then a couple years later, people say, you know, we should do something along those lines. could be, or maybe that's just a petty man, self-serving analysis. But it's also the case that further out we get, the harder it is to come up with ideas. So people get, the standards maybe, you know, get honored in the breach.
Yeah, I know I've heard Al Jean joke about that they can't, you guys have run out of every holiday at this point, or except for Arbor Day.
Yes. We're working on an episode that I'm kind of excited about that takes advantage of the national holiday-like thing that is March Madness, you know? Yeah, and so I think that, I feel like there's a way to make the structure of March Madness part of the narrative, you know, the sequence of narrowing down and all that. We haven't quite figured out, but I feel like, yeah, it's kind of a thing, you know, if we can do March Madness, it's kind of a thing, we can... You know, I don't think other people have done it. Don't hear this yet.
Okay.
I don't know where you're going with this, but I do want to say at some point, talk a little bit about The Great Gatsby.
Oh, sure, go for it.
Totally.
Okay. For me, that episode is a research. The backstory, if I may, is pretty good. I wanted to do an episode with a stronger African-American theme and presence. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to do that because I had been in a Big Brother program and my mentee was African-American, and it just made me more conscious of like wanting him to feel ownership of the show, you know? Hmm. And so then I thought, well, you know, there's a reason they haven't done very much in like that all these years. They're, you know, so why don't I do something that, you know, is very reassuring, like the sort of stuff that the show does. And, you know, Mr. Burns gets a rich friend, you know? Mm-hmm. So like that will make it safer. We'll do Mr. Burns gets a billionaire, your black friend. And then that's why it became Jay-Z. And then, so I worked out this whole thing where Mr. Burns and Jay-Z become best friends, and then they become rivals, and they're all falling out. And I pitched it at the table with, of course, a giant rap battle, which I had written the raps for. And
wow, amazing.
And so, if you want to talk about epic fails, you can talk about epic fails, but I really ate it hard then. James L. Brooks was not having it, and there was a stony silence that greeted that pitch. But and I thought it was super dead, and you know, I was just like, okay, I'm just going to slink back to my seat and wait out for the rest of the day. But then it turned out Matt Groening had really liked it, and he made a case for it in their private conference afterwards, and it came back to life.
Nice.
And then, yeah, and so and it was only a half-hour episode, of course, and then when we read at the table, Mr. Brooks, Jen liked it so much that he now went the other direction and made it an hour episode, which was frightening, too, because, you know, how many half-hour shows do a good hour, you know? But, you know, for me, there's also the danger that to make it an hour would have meant let's add like another story to it, you know, and that would make it lose its identity, you know, if it just had like the hip hop world as just act one. So I was pleased that we found a way to sort of add more beats to that story and keep it in that world, you know.
Yeah, it was a big thing just in Simpsons history too to have another, I guess, technically two parters or two episodes together, because Who Shot Mr. Burns was really the only other one.
Right. This is really an hour long that can be broken in two versus a two parter. Mm-hmm. You know, but the other thing is, you know, we got a lot of publicity in places we don't always get publicity. You know, we got, you know, covered in all the African American publications and radio stations, and you know, and that might not reflect itself in our, you know, the audio the AV club review or something. Mm-hmm. But to me, I don't know, it's like very gratifying that happened.
That is something that the Simpsons like. Yeah, that is a audience the Simpsons doesn't always reach, I would suspect.
Right. Well, I think the hardcore, the you guys of it, who are our best fans, our most committed fans, you might not overlap with that community, and that community doesn't necessarily they're not as into The Simpsons as that, but what, you know what, seeing an episode that's more relevant to your life, I think was gratifying, you know, and yeah. We went and recorded Snoop Dogg at his studio and in his compound, and he had, you know, it's a very impressive situation, he has murals all over the world, but there's at least one, maybe two images of Bart Simpson painted on his walls.
Oh, wow.
And so he's clearly a fan. You know, after he did his lines, which we were unable to get our producer on the phone, he simultaneously recorded them and produced them, you know, and laid down like five different tracks right there, like first reading it, sing it this way, then that way. And like he knew what he was doing. And he was, of course, you know, he's a worldwide star. He's a slightly intimidating and, you know, we weren't really hanging with him so much. But even after he did the line, he pumped his, you know, fist in the air and said, you know, I'm on The Simpsons. You
know? That's awesome.
I thought that's pretty good. If Snoop Dogg, if it means something to Snoop Dogg, that's pretty good.
We will wrap up very shortly, but I did want to ask about your relationship with the fans, because you wrote for the show when it was a very polarizing show for fans. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious as to what your experiences was like there.
Like some particular polarizing episode I wrote or some...
Oh, just the general sense from the fandom you had then when it was polarizing, like on, you know, the no homers of the world.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know. I've never really read that stuff that seriously. I mean, I no homer type guys are all my friends and whatever. And it's like, yeah, I get it. You know, but I don't feel like I work for them. Like, I love them. They're welcome to have their opinion and, you know, God bless them. But I'm not going to internalize it to the point where I feel like their constraints, I work for their constraints, you know, because that doesn't work, frankly. You know, that there's a freedom that's required and to have something be fresh. And if you get too long a laundry list of mistakes and errors and rules, it just shrinks the strike zone to the point where it kind of kills the joy, you know? So, you know, let them complain. I don't think they're necessarily wrong, but I'm not going to worry about it. And just, you know, the things I've done some stuff that I've, you know, wish was better. And I don't know, it's not like I think everything I do is great, but I don't know if the things that I'm not happy about are the ones that they're not happy with or not. I don't know.
I had a couple more things I wanted to ask. First off, in the writer's room, you know, you've been there since season 7, it's season 30, and there's some other folks who have been in there a long time too, Ian Maxtone Graham, Selman, Gamelin Prost, but there's also a lot of new hires, including, I believe, like Megan Amram, who is a great writer, just joined the staff. Like, is there kind of, what's like the multi-generational feel on such a, you know, deep-rooted staff as The Simpsons is?
It has a sort of family feeling, you know? I don't know, we all really get along and really like that. It's always very, you know, fun and exciting when somebody new comes in and like brings a new set of ideas and references and perspectives. You know, you feel a little bad. Like, I hope we're not bumming them out too much with our old lameness. But on the other hand, my dear friend Kevin Curran, who died last year, you know, there's nobody anywhere who can bring it more than Kevin can bring it. You know, because a lot of times with young people, they're rooted in received stuff. You know, like, oh, they know this thing, they know that show, they know that show, and they're really involved with what they're taking in, and you know, sometimes their work comes back like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas like Kevin's so radically like free, like in his like it's almost like to get to where he gets, it takes longer. Mm-hmm. Like his comedy was the most unformulaic and most spontaneous of anybody I've worked with. Not necessarily always the most useful, but definitely the best, like, performance art. Like, to be in the room with Kevin for, you know, a couple hours was like seeing a spontaneous performance art comedian at the top of his game. And I don't, young people are fine, but they ain't there yet.
Well, I guess my last question would be, you know, the show's entered its 30th season, and The Simpsons just got bought by Disney, or I don't know if it's completely signed, sealed, and delivered yet, but I mean, what is your impression of the future? I just saw Al Jean say he thinks the show will keep going, and that season 30, though contractually the final one, is he doesn't think is going to be the final one. But what do you feel about the future of The Simpsons?
I feel that there will be a Simpsons, and that it will retain probably the core team, you know, your Al's and your Selmans. Whether you get down to the lower men on the totem pole, there might be some wiggle room there. You know, somebody might think that we could free up that salary. So I don't, you know, I can see how that might be coming my way.
Wow.
Whatever. Just try to take it one joke at a time, baby, you know? So I don't know. I will see. Like I said, they did great shows before I got there. I'm sure they'll do great ones after I'm gone. But I'm going to hang on as long as I can. Like the barnacle that I am.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dan. Is there anything outside of The Simpsons that you want to promote? Anything else you're working on or have worked on?
Well, I didn't think of that, but I have a community project called Bailiwick. And it's spelled like the word Bailiwick, but without the C. And it's an attempt to create real-world community using the Internet. And it's something like Nextdoor, but philosophically very different. The mission is much more community and connecting. So if anybody feels like checking that out and joining, that would be fun. There's awesome. No need. There's no joke. There's no jokes on it.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you both. Thank you for having me on. And I don't know who you're future guests are, but I would pitch Steve Tompkins and Dan McGrath, you know, as people who actually made a big contribution in the seasons 7 and 8 that you're particularly interested in. It might not necessarily, people might not always mention that to you. Like, Dan McGrath is an extremely original writer who was on there in two different stints, you know, but early seasons and then season 7 and 8. And, like, for instance, I know one thing he pitched was when Bart gets a new dog, that fantasy where Bart's like worried about what became of the old dog.
The dog's being put into the furnace. I love that gag.
And, if you can help us
Dan
get in.
Dan pitched that for a story reason, that Bart, and for an emotional reason, Bart needed to have some consequences. He needs to be a human being. He needs to have some feelings about what he's just done to his dog. So Bart, Dan noticed that we needed that, and then he pitched this hilarious solution, you know, with this shovel on more dogs, Lumley. You know, So, you know, there's, it is a, while the written by credit can be taken to over get too much credit to the credited author, there's other way that the ensemble dimension just is harder to capture. And I just want to say those are two people that were great members of the ensemble in that era.
Yeah, if you could help us get in touch with them at some point in the future, we'd definitely appreciate it.
And we'd love to chat with them. Yeah.
Absolutely. I can dig up their contact.
Awesome. Thanks for the recommendations.
Oh, man, yeah, totally. And thanks so much for your time. You really embiggened our podcast, I would say.
I hope it was cromulent.
Very, very cromulent. Thank you, Dan.
Damn it. All right. Thank you.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that interview. I had a lot of fun on it. Dan, obviously, as a Simpsons writer, he's a very funny guy. That should not be a surprise. But I say, if you like this interview, reach out to Dan on Twitter. His name is DanGreaney. That's at DanGreaney. And let him know that you enjoy the interview. I think when we interviewed Bill Oakley for the first time, he said he's never gotten more feedback. And I think that's why we got him a second time. So if you want to see more interviews like this, please say thank you to these great writers we talked to.
Yeah, I really appreciate Dan giving us his time. Especially while still working on the show and, you know, being a full-time Simpsons comedy writer. And two, just reflecting back on some of his biggest moments on the show. Same in, I really loved all that talk about Bart to the future and the sadness of future Bart, as well as, you know, deconstructing the Donald Trump joke in there as well.
Yes.
But it was a really good podcast. And one last time, I want to thank Dan so much. And I look forward to tons more interviews like this one in the future, and we can score them with certain Simpsons folks.
Yes, no spoilers. We're planning some big ones coming up soon. I don't want to knock on wood, you know, but it's going to happen, I swear.
Some big plans.
Exactly. So, yes, thank you for listening, folks, and thank you for giving to the Patreon, and we'll see you for the next interview or next fun episode we do. Bye.
Infotainment.